Listening to WAIF Cincinnati 88.3 FM. That was Peter Kater and Sodom Carr from their new album, Heart of the Universe. The song was Song of Your Heart. You're listening to WAIF Cincinnati 88.3 FM. Soul-filled sounds and conscious conversation every Tuesday afternoon right here on WAIF. I'm your host this afternoon, Tara Robinson, and I would like to thank our underwriters. Our show is made possible in part by the Conscious Living Center, supporting people on their journey of well-being with counseling, coaching, workshops, and the School of Conscious Living. The Enneagram is used for their work in self-understanding, compassion, and transformation. More information about the Conscious Living Center can be found at www.goconscious.com. At this time, it's my joy and honor to welcome to the program one of my new very favorite authors. Her name is Mary Hayes Greco, and she is a respected author and spiritual teacher and therapist. She's also the director of the Midwest Institute for Forgiveness Training and has been a presenter in a wide variety of professional venues, including the 2005 Nobel Peace Prize Forum. She's the author of Unconditional Forgiveness, a simple and proven method to forgive everyone and everything, and the author of the newly released book, The New Kitchen Mystic, which is a collection of essays, and the subtitle is A Companion for Spiritual Explorers. Mary, welcome to the program this afternoon.
Thank you, Tara.
So we are definitely spiritual explorers on this program, and when I received your book, I knew instantly that it was a great fit. And I have to tell you, I told our listeners this earlier in the program, that this is the type of book, and this has not happened very often, but this is the type of book that grabbed me from the very first sentence. And I have to say, it's quite a feat to write something like that because, yeah, I mean, most people, we're accustomed to knowing that it takes a while to get into a book. Sometimes we'll even lend a book to a friend and we'll say that. We'll say, you know, it takes a little bit to get into it, but just stick with it because you'll love it. And this was really amazing because it's almost like one of those moments that's imprinted on my mind. Ironically, or maybe not so much, I was standing in my kitchen and I was kind of waiting for the pot to boil for dinner, and the book was sitting on the counter, and I picked it up and was immediately engrossed in it and knew it would become one of my very favorites.
That's wonderful. Were you cutting onions at the time?
Right. I read your story about the onions. I was not cutting onions. I was just waiting for the water to boil.
I see. That's just as good.
Yes.
The holy tea.
Yes, exactly. So one of the things that I love the most about this book that I want to be sure to express to, because I think it's really important for our listeners to know, anyone who has not yet read the book or bought the book or whatever, I love the kind of writer that you are. You are a really, really, really phenomenal writer.
And oh my goodness, this is a great radio show so far for me.
It's a great radio show. I know, with lots of compliments, right? Well, I don't say that lightly because, first of all, being a fellow writer myself, and not only a writer but an editor for a major publication, and a lot of work comes across my desk, and actually a lot of really fabulous books. And what I've found over the years is that some authors can write a really fabulous book that contains beautiful ideas and really important messages, but they're not necessarily like a beautifully gifted writer where reading the sentences feels like a delicious hot bubble bath all by themselves. That is, you write in that way. I have so many passages underlined and highlighted, not just because of what it's saying, but it's how you say it. And, oh, it's so juicy and wonderful. I just love it.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Thank you so much. That's just really gratifying to hear. And I have to say, I've met a lot of stands of my book over the years, from the first time it came out, and they're always carrying it around underlined and highlighted and, you know, bent down, and they're pulling it out and quoting me to myself. It's really nice.
I don't know how many authors really get to have that experience, but I know for myself that would just be like the ultimate compliment. You know, I mean, that anything that I write, that is how I want it to be received. You know, that's sort of the intention that it goes out with is, you know,
that's right.
Just be like dog-eared worthy to the reader.
Yes, and it's very gratifying for me because I guess, I feel that with my book out there and everyone finding it who finds it, we become friends in some way. That I hear from many people, I felt like you were writing exactly to my heart. I feel like you're my friend. I feel like you really get it. And I believe that is because in each of the moments in my life that I was writing one of those essays, I was kind of at a white heat of really striving for some universal understanding of something, and like I was really chewing on a bone, if you will, an idea, a thought, a wound, a concept. I was really seeking truth when I was writing, and I guess I wanted it badly enough that while I was writing, I would alter my consciousness, and a lot of light would come through that it was, you know, a little bit beyond my little self that was writing, and I would read it later, and I'd say, wow, that's good, that's true, did I know that? And I think each piece I wrote, I was writing with everything in me, because I'm just very passionate about my spiritual quest, and I feel like life is thrown me a lot of questions to chew on, and so I think that may be one of the reasons the writing remains perennial, because we all are asking the same questions and trying to deal with the same dilemmas about being a human being. So so that was a lucky thing. And then, of course, I'm 100% Irish, and we love words. Words, words, words. Love the words. Grew up on poetry and good literature. All around me, so I think that maybe comes through too.
It definitely does, and that helps to explain that. I didn't know that, as you know, sort of a general statement that the Irish love words, but it definitely, like I said, is apparent for you in the book. And it's interesting that you said everyone or a lot of people who read your book, you find them making the comment over and over that they feel like you're their friend, and that you do become friends with your readers. And I think you have such a strong intention of that in the book. I mean, in fact, it's even the very first sentence in the introduction of the book. You start by saying, "Hello, my friend." And so you immediately make the assumption that, you know, us as the readers are your friends. And you just lay it out there right from the very beginning. The way you speak throughout the book is like talking to a friend. And coming here to the station today, that was sort of the visual that I got in my head. I was so looking forward to this interview, again, just because I love your book so much. And for anyone who's just tuning in, it's The New Kitchen Mystic by Mary Hayes Greco. And the way that I imagined that this conversation going was like both of us sitting on this great big comfy couch. This is a big comfy couch conversation kind of book.
Absolutely, absolutely. And, you know, actually I used to have a radio show in the Twin Cities, and it was called The Blue Couch, because I guess that's the quality of discourse that I like to enjoy, is that sense of, oh, great, let's get comfortable. Let's get the cup of tea. Let's sit down now. Let's really chew on it. Let's really talk about true things, and let's really share. And I guess I feel really blessed that people have valued the book so much. And in fact, one time when I was traveling in Ireland, I was giving I've traveled quite a bit in my work, but when I went to Ireland, the home of my forebears, I was given the name of someone to stay with. And when she heard my name on the phone, she said, "Oh, I've been wanting to talk to you forever. I've got your book right here." And she's a writer, too. And when I met her down at the pub to, you know, connect and go home for the evening, she had my book, and there it was, all yellowed and underlined, and she had arguments. She was, some of the things she was arguing with me about, she had said, I've been wanting to argue with you for a long time. So that was kind of funny. I said, okay, well, let's get comfortable. Let's get comfortable and talk about these things.
And dive right in. Well, that's great. Yeah. That's what I want to do is I do just want to dive right in, and I want to start, I want to start at the beginning, and I want to talk about kitchen mysticism, which I love, because you talk about the kitchen being where we perform important but mundane acts, and kitchen mysticism cultivates the awareness of direct, intimate communion with the divine in the arena of everyday existence. And then I love this part. I'm going to read a passage and tie it all together. Kitchen mystics may or may not attend an organized church. They find convenient places to commune and worship. The shower, the car, a park bench at sunset. You will often spot mystics muttering earnestly to someone no one else can see or stopping mid-project with an entranced look, listening. They are performing one of the major practices of faith, conducting an ongoing, loving dialogue between the God within and the God without. We kitchen mystics entertain each other with accounts of synchronicity and breakthrough insights we experience. Each person's spiritual truth is developed by a direct experience of God in a mystical moment through a personal history of mystical moments. Now, I took those passages from, you know, it's sort of a smattering from different pages at the beginning of the book. And what I love about this is that, first of all, it speaks into that experience of encountering your spiritual self, which is deeply intimate, and it's everywhere. It's intimate and it's infinite. And what's really important is when we find the people on our journeys, our soul companions, our spiritual companions who we're traveling with, because when we find someone who speaks our language, it's like food for our soul to be able to share that. When you say each person's spiritual truth is developed by a direct experience of God in a mystical moment through a personal history of mystical moments, but those are the types of moments we long to share, and yet we can't. That's not the type of conversation you have with someone standing in the line at the grocery store. It may not even be the kind of conversation you have with your spouse and your life partner. You have to find the spiritual companions who have similar moments to share with you. Is that correct?
That's so true. That is so true. And I don't know why I keep talking about Ireland today. I don't always, for some reason, it's kind of present, but they have a term for it over there in their spirituality, which is quite lovely. And as a fellow writer, you'll love the sound of it. I think it's Anamkara. It means soul friend. Isn't that beautiful?
Oh,
Anamkara.
There's a name for it.
There's a name for that person that you can get together with and tell them anything, and that they'll enter your experience with you, and they'll open up to trying to share and penetrate that, you know, that intimate understanding that you're so involved with and that you like to share with someone. And so there's actually a whole book called Anamkara, written by John O'Donohue, who's a wonderful writer. But so that's one term for it. And then I have another one that I like. I have a group of spiritual buddies that we get together about 8 times a year, and we have a circle, and we check in, and we meditate, and we do a lot of cooking and laughing and dancing, and we teach each other things. We set up little classes for each other, and we take turns teaching spiritual things to each other. But I call them my mighty companions, with a capital M and a capital C, because I think everyone's journey is a hero's journey. Every one of us is dealing with things that are scary or hard for us at times, and we are being brave like heroes at times, and we need our mighty companions at our side to help us feel even braver.
Yes, we absolutely do. And what great words to use, and what a wonderful picture, because, you know, I think of a hero's journey when I've heard that before as like this really, you know, intense, like personal. You're doing this deep soul work. And I know that is one way you mean it. But when you talk about the mighty companions, it's like this whole superhero analogy. Going out into the world with the with your caped, you know, friends by your side. That is awesome. And it is so important. That's why I think your book is really such an important work, because for people who are just becoming conscious of this aspect of their lives, and I say it like that because everyone has this element in their lives, but there's a point where we awaken to it and we suddenly become conscious that this is a force and that this is a dynamic in our lives, and we recognize it when we read the words of other people or hear someone else talk. And so we don't necessarily just automatically enter that arena where we have these soul companions or spiritual companions. It's almost like we travel alone for a little bit until we really begin to understand what it is that's going on and what to look for in other people to be able to recognize the signs. And sometimes a book can be our greatest companion, especially at the beginning when we aren't quite speaking the language yet and we haven't necessarily created that circle of support around us, but we find our truth in the writings of other people, and I just think it's really important.
Yes, you find your mighty companions, your friends out there. My best friend, who we use the word Anamkara for each other, she said that long ago when we met 30 years ago. She said, I was traveling along and I knew the ground under my feet well enough, but I was lonely. I was lonely. I had lots of people around me, but I was still kind of lonely. And then as I was traveling along, I looked over and there you were traveling next to me. And there was this other friend of ours traveling next to me. And she just burst into tears of gratefulness. And she said, You just came out of the bushes, and there you were, and now we're together the rest of our lives. It's really a great thing to be able to meet soul friends.
Oh, it is, and we can just have such gratitude for that, especially because we know what it's like to be lonely without them. So one of the sections of your book that I loved particularly much, and it kind of sums it all up in the title of the chapter, is the Serenity Prayer. It's all there.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the reasons that I like this particularly much is because I came into my own truth that the Serenity Prayer, it's all there. Right before I read this, I found myself going through this repeated process where whatever it was that I was struggling with in my life, I kept finding myself circling back to the Serenity Prayer. And one day I was like, man, it's just always, 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 always about the Serenity Prayer. It's like learning when to accept and when to change and the wisdom to know the difference between the two. And I thought, that's really, you know, a whole book could be written on just the Serenity Prayer. And it was
like, that's so cool that you came to that. Yes, it's so cool that you came to that understanding just before you read it, too. And I have to say, and I've been around the 12-step program for 30 years, and because my dad was an alcoholic, and I've, you know, found a lot of healing and help in Al-Anon and adult children and alcoholics groups. And so I have stood in circle, I don't know, thousands of times with some group of people, different groups, different people, different places over the years. And it's always a powerful moment to stand in a circle of people and say that little prayer, that simple little prayer that has the beginning and the end of the whole spiritual journey in it. It's mm-hmm. all there. It really is. And I think every time I say it in a group, I feel like I'm hearing it again for the first time. And I'm thinking, yeah, it's acceptance. It's really acceptance. Or, oh, yeah, I got to do something. I have to take a step here. mm-hmm. Oh, what is it? So it's really one of those perennial gifts that we have.
It really is. And sometimes, you know, like you said, it's kind of like the beginning and the end and everything in between, you know, because it's also like those moments where we're struggling for the clarity. I know for myself, it will be like, I'm perfectly willing to take action. I'll overcome my fear, whatever needs to be done, as long as I know that's really what I'm supposed to do, you know? I'm like being asked to accept here by being asked to move. What is it? What is it? And it's like, gosh, if we just, you know, always had that wisdom of knowing which one it is and finding the balance. So I'd like to ask you to just talk a little bit more about that for the moment, like what the Serenity Prayer is and the different ways that you see that playing out in life.
Sure.
I love the part where you say that East and West meet here.
Yeah, let's talk about that. So first of all, for anyone who's not familiar with it, I'm still surprised when I meet people who've never heard it, but here it is. It's God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. And my contemplation around this prayer is to say that, in a way, it's got the whole world of spirituality in it. It's got East and West in it. I'll just read a little bit here. Eastern wisdom teaches us to accept life. There's nowhere you have to go. It's all right here. Everything you see is equally one, an expression of God's consciousness in a myriad of forms. Be at peace with what you are, here, now. Accept. Western wisdom says, you can be something more than you are right now. Strive for it. Life can be better. You can use your knowledge and your will to make things, changes that advance evolution. There is no problem that cannot be solved, and no creative innovation is beyond your reach. Courage. It is the wisdom of the whole that knows which wisdom must predominate now, though each is bound to the other, inseparable partners in the dance of creation through time. So, I guess I built on that understanding in the next part of the piece where I was talking about it's a whole different way of living if you clearly know that you're in acceptance of something, or if you clearly know that you're expressing your will to create something new or different, than to be kind of in the middle in a mishmash of sort of trying. And I wrote about how people who are not grounded in acceptance and wisdom and a clear use of will, often we find ourselves leading trying lives, leading difficult lives. But it's actually because we're trying instead of willing, or we're trying instead of being, instead of accepting. And I had a wonderful teacher who taught me something important about that once. It's kind of like Yoda in Star Wars, and he'd say, no try, only do, only do. She said to me, well, so, Mary, are you going to do blah, 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 some, you know, thing that I had said I wanted to make happen? And I'd say, well, I'm going to try and do that. And she'd look at me with her 86-year-old eyes, and she'd say, oh, no, no, no. We won't have any trying here. Will you or will you not? And that has stayed with me for many, many years. And I want to live in such a way that I'm conscious moment by moment of whether I'm in a situation that's about being and accepting the way it is, or am I in a time where I need to be being brave and moving things and using my will to good effect. And it's that wisdom that comes from the higher self that lets you know the difference. And so I find myself contacting my source of wisdom in the morning to understand more about accepting and willing. What's mine to do? What's mine to be? And what is your will for me today?
Mm-hmm. I think sometimes we pretend to not know the answer when really we do know. And I love the whole passage about trying, because I also had a similar and very profound experience with that word again, like crazily right before I came across it in your book. I was working through a serious, like, deep grief issue, and I was in a healing session with someone facilitating the healing, and we reached the part where she said, you know, are you willing to let go of this now? And it was important, you know, for me to make the statement. And I remember looking at her like with these, you know, red, puffy, you know, almost closed eyes. And I said, I'll try. And she said, no. She said, trying is something that you do between choosing yes or no. She said, let me ask you again, are you willing to let go now? And it was like her speaking to me like that really called me into accountability. And what was fascinating to me is that the moment before when she asked me and I responded, I'll try, you know, or I'm trying, that was really my honest answer. I felt like that was the most honest I could be, because I didn't feel like I could say yes and mean it. And yet, when she said, trying is something that you do between choosing yes or no, then it became crystal clear to me that the only answer I could give was yes. And whether it was in fact true or not that I could fully go there, my intention had to be yes if I was ever going to get on the other side. And that was just an incredibly profound moment for me.
It sounds like it. It's a very powerful story. And it also, it kind of links to my other work, the 8 steps of forgiveness, forgiving another person, because the first step of accomplishing forgiveness, which is healing oneself, is that willingness. Are you willing? Are you willing to let this go now? Are you willing? And it's so interesting how long it might take someone just to get to that step. I've actually had people call me up to register for a forgiveness workshop, and I'll say, oh, well, how'd you hear about it? You know, on the radio, or did you post her? And she'd say, no, I've had your card in my purse for 10 years. I just woke up today and thought, I've got to do this. I've got to forgive my ex-husband now. And I thought, wow, how mysterious it is, the life of the will when it comes to our really big emotional issues is what makes us ready finally. So that's an interesting moment you were pivoting on between, and will I? Okay, I will. Yeah, that's really, really great.
Right, yes. And I know your forgiveness work that you do is huge, and that you've actually, you know, built such a huge platform around that. And I do want to get into that in just a moment. I want to welcome our listeners who might just be joining us, because we're almost at the top of the hour here. For anyone who's just now tuning in, you're listening to WAIF Cincinnati 88.3 FM. I'm your host today, Tara Robinson, and you're listening to Soul-Filled Sounds and Conscious Conversation on the air every Tuesday afternoon from 3 to 5 p.m. Today, Mary Hayes Greco is my guest, and she is the author of the well-known Unconditional Forgiveness, a Simple and Proven Method to Forgive Everyone and Everything. And she's also the author of one of my new very favorite books, The New Kitchen Mystic, A Companion for Spiritual Explorers. So, Mary, before we leave this part of the Serenity Prayer, I want to read what you've written here at the end of this chapter, because, again, you being such a good writer, there's no way I can put it in my own words and have it sound nearly as well as you wrote it. You say, as we continue to mature, acceptance is no longer a thought or a process. It is a relaxed, open state of being. It is the state of being empty and full simultaneously, established in the present and a container of positive potential in every moment for everyone. Free and powerful human beings, enlightened masters, live in this manner. These saints have become established in the acceptance of life. They are radiant lights of peace, love, and joy, regardless of their environment or circumstances. The will of their personalities is so powerfully aligned with the divine will that miraculous things are accomplished through them all the time with no effort. So before we leave this chapter, I wanted to ask you to talk for a moment about what it means to align the will of our personalities with the divine will. I think that is just such a cool statement.
Oh, thank you. Well, I guess I've been blessed by being able to witness a few masterful souls that were doing this 24/7. It's been my great blessing to have a personal mentor in Dr. Stauffer, who developed the forgiveness work. And I met her when she was 76 and hung out with her till she was 90. And I watched somebody who had really healed and polished her personal self so that she was like a flute with spirit blowing wind and beautiful music through her all of the time. It was something so relaxed and calm, and yet like this amazing firm will that was operating through her for everyone's highest good, for everyone's benefit. And that's what I want to grow up to be. I want to be that when I grow up. And the work that I am most grounded in was that I believe is getting me there from here is a holistic psychology called psychosynthesis. It was developed by a brilliant, brilliant psychiatrist named Dr. Saggioli from Italy. And my teacher was his student, and I was her student. And this forgiveness work and really the work I use most often in my coaching and healing is grounded in this idea that I'm a personality with a body and emotions and a mind, and I'm a soul, an eternal soul who's in the heart of spirit for all eternity. And my soul is my eternal self, my eternal light that I am being guided by. And my personality is the vehicle with which my soul is learning her lessons and bringing her service to this world. And so the soul and the personal self learn to work together to form a synthesis, to form a combined self that is, a unique personality, has its quirks and strengths and weaknesses and things, influences from our background, but there's also something about us that's cosmic, that's universal, that is able to show up to all situations and see the same good self in every person. So that's what I'm striving for. I'm striving to heal and synthesize and integrate my personality within itself, and then to ground and channel, if you will, to let it flow like a river, the light of my soul in service to others. So I've been on this path for a good 30 years since I met my teacher, and I'm beginning to feel some of the smoothness of that commitment developing. I'm beginning to feel more and more palpably like I'm in a stream, like I'm in a stream of creative service, and that I'm not striving or trying or resisting or pushing, but that I'm allowing and I'm kind of going along on the stream of life.
That's so beautifully said. So, I mean, even just as you're speaking, I'm sort of getting that in a new way. Can you say again what, you don't have to say it exactly the same way, I just want to kind of emphasize that for a minute, because I think this is the important material for all of our listeners to hear. You talked about, so it's this dance with the personality and the soul, and you said you've worked to ground your personality so that the stream of the light of your soul can come through. Is that
right? It's kind of like you bring your body, emotions, and mind, and history, and genetics, and background, and training, and interests, all of that becomes synthesized, woven together as one thing, so that you're not like one person today and another person yesterday and another person tomorrow. And, you know, you're not doing things unconsciously anymore that are causing messes in your life, that your personality is in service to the service of your soul. And so that as I work and as I teach my workshops, I always say a prayer when I walk in to my workshop. And it's kind of a little practice. When I get to the doorway of the room, I say, you know, out loud to myself, okay, stepping aside, and this is yours, meaning to spirit, you know, this is your workshop, and use me, use my personality, use my soul to teach this particular group of people what they need. So, and I think everyone is like that, whether you're a teacher or a car mechanic or a mother or a gardener. There's anyone you ever meet who's really excellent at what they do and really calm in doing it have on some level done that. They've created some kind of a synthesis in their basic self that allows the stream of service to come through them effortlessly.
Mm. Well, that ties in just perfectly with the section of your book where you talk about humility. And I love the way you describe humility and in fact, your journey with humility, kind of at the very beginning about how you say you were in therapy and you told your therapist asks you why you're afraid to have power. And you say, well, I've been taught by my religious upbringing that I should be humble and not call attention to myself or ask for too much for myself. And really what happened is you came to the realization, I love what you say actually to my surprise when she asks you, but what does humility really mean to you? You say, to my surprise, my own voice answered from an inner knowing, humility is taking one's rightful place in the universe. And what you were just saying about the personalities and the unique gifts combined with the personal history and, you know, each one of us have a rightful place. And in that place, once we really grasp the truth of that, then all the fear and angst and struggle with competition goes away because there's no threat for anyone to take our rightful place because no one can. It's our own rightful place, just the same as we should not be attempting to take someone else's rightful place in them doing what they're doing. And so you say it's not a matter of high or low. Generally, people think of humility as taking the lowest position, but it's not a matter of high or low. It's just a matter of taking your rightful place. So I'd like you to talk about that for a moment.
It comes to mind that one of the people we most admire in our society, Martin Luther King, was often struggling with his role as a leader, and he often felt like, "Hey, I'm not the one. I'm not the guy to do this. I'm a preacher, yeah, but I never meant to be the leader of the civil rights movement, and I'm not good enough. I don't have enough organizational skills. I can't do this. I can't do that." But somehow, the movement of people, and this liberation movement, and the whole energy of what was happening in those days kept landing right at his feet and kept saying, "Martin, you speak it. Martin, you do it. Martin, you go there. Martin, you be the representative. Martin, you do it." And so even though he was being asked to be a leader, he was being asked to go front and center and talk to presidents and be on television, it was actually a humble thing that he agreed to do that. So it's kind of a reverse notion of how we think about humility. It's not really taking a back seat. It's really being you and not questioning your worthiness, your right to be in the place you're in. Another place in that essay I talk about how it's actually a form of arrogance for us to withhold our light, to withhold our purposes and our service. And if you looked around in the prairie and you saw these prairie flowers, and some of them were big and grand, some of them were tiny and darling, none of them are withholding because they're not, you know, just the most amazing color, or they are, you know, the little ones are not saying, well, you know, I'm not going to bloom today. The flowers bloom. The birds sing. The trees spread their branches. Everything in creation is asked to be its most natural self. And for we humans, that's a more difficult task. We have a hard time being our most natural selves because we're so complex. But that's what makes us interesting. And so I think it's just very wonderful that we're in a time of real awakening, a real question and real resource all around us, where there's so many teachers and so many bodies of healing work and spiritual paradigms emerging that are helping us take our place to find that union between soul and personality that feels comfortable and to really let it happen.
Mm-hmm. Well, speaking of the times that we're in, that was a really fascinating part of the book to me. I would say eye-opening, and in fact, I can feel resistance in myself as to, like, how exactly to deal with this information. The part where you talk about that we are living in the age of Kali, and my resistance is that I can absolutely see everything that you're saying about that, and I'll explain more in a minute. I know you're the only one who's understanding me. Our listeners, if they haven't read this, are like, what on earth is she talking about?
What is she talking about, Kali?
Right. Exactly. But, you know, so it's like, even though I can see that everything you're saying is true, I feel like, but do I want to, like, buy into that truth? I clearly have not made peace with this issue. So I'm going to talk about this for a second, and I'll let you talk about Kali too. The idea is that in the Hindu tradition, God is seen as a trinity. There is God the creator, God the sustainer, and God the destroyer, also known as Kali. Am I pronouncing that right? I've heard it Kali. Kali.
I've heard it as Kali.
Kali. Okay, Kali. So Kali is the goddess of destruction. And one of the most poignant parts of the book is where you tell your story about the miscarriage. And I want to read this for our listeners because I think this is a compelling reason to buy the book, because your writing here is, you know, there's lots of good stuff like this in the book. And you say, I've been forced to make friends with Bloody Kali and learn to accept her as one of my teachers during a personal catastrophe I experienced, a life-threatening miscarriage that took place in the fifth month of a pregnancy. This moment with Kali is seared into my psyche and is one of my most treasured scars. I mean, I love that. One of my most treasured scars. All of us need to think about that. The onset of my loss and catastrophe was sudden and dramatic. I awoke suddenly from sleep at 5 a.m. with a gushing hemorrhage. I sprang from bed and sprinted down the hall to the bathroom, shouting for my husband as I ran. I sat on the toilet, which I just can't even believe this. I sat on the toilet, cupping a perfect little fetus in my hands, and stared at it in wonder and surprise while my blood fell around him like a steady rain. My mouth was wide open, and so was his. It was a tragic comic moment. I felt like the baby and I were looking at each other and saying, huh? That tiny open mouth reminded me of all the human huh that ever were. Oh, gosh, that is so... I don't even know where you're writing from there, but it's clearly
I was writing from the white heat of loss of that baby and the astonishing moment I had in the bathroom in which I felt that I perceived the presence of the goddess Kali for a few moments. And in this tradition, you know, it says destruction's part of it. It's part of our world. The volcano, the hurricane, the murder, the car accident, the unexpected things that have just toppled our worlds and shocked us. Even in those moments, God is there. God is there. So I was writing from right fresh from that space, and it was kind of a harder choice to put that one in the book. But and so I can't even believe we're reading it on the radio. But okay, let's go there. the goddess Kali is ever since then has been something that I've found some peace with. So when I look around and disastrous things are happening, what I really see is all the love that is broken open in those moments. There's so much love that is broken open in those moments we watch on the news when people are rushing into the building to, you know, bring out the survivors or bringing aid to a village that's been decimated by a tsunami. What we're really meditating on there is not, oh, isn't life awful? We're not. We're being brave, and we're looking at the worst that can happen, and we're saying, and God is here. God is here. Look at the love and the service pouring out of this person right now. That's a lot what this piece is about.
Well, and that's definitely so significant. That was sort of like the, you know, the period at the end of that chapter, literally, but also for me figuratively, because, you know, you wrap up that chapter by saying the Hindus say that we live in the age of Kali, and then you go on to provide evidence for that. You know, it's because every night of their own free will, millions of viewers settle down in their pajamas to hear the stories and view the images of violence, loss, struggle, and shocking events that our mass media pumps right into our living rooms. And you're right, we do that absolutely of our own free will. There's nothing that makes a better news day than catastrophe. And I was like, this really was a challenge for me because I know that that's true, but I've never questioned that it could be any other way, like that there would be another age that we could live in, because that's just always how it is. As far as I knew, you know, the news is always about disaster. But the fact that we're kind of at a point in human evolution where we're just, you know, soaking all of that up as much as we possibly can get. And I'm wondering, you know, what's next? Is God as the creator, I guess it's all kind of happening simultaneously all the time, but in terms of what is truly earmarking our experience and our existence, you know, does it cycle through like that? I mean, when the Hindus say that we live in the age of Kali, like, is there another age to come?
Well, there's different mythological understandings of where we are in time. You could look at the Mayan calendar, and they're saying, oh, no, we're on the brink of the age of flowers. We're about to start 1,000 years of peace and harmony in the age of flowers. And you could look at the Jewish calendar, and it's you know, got different years in it than different understandings of time than other ways. But you bring up a really interesting question, and I find myself thinking about it in a brand new way this moment. And you said, well, what is this mean that we're really, really, as a whole world, we're really meditating on these terrible things all together, all at once. You know, because in the old days, you couldn't do that. You couldn't talk on the BBC and have people listen to the BBC on the radio and have people call in from Africa and call in from France and call in from Cincinnati. It's an amazing time. And so this, in the same way, when we're dealing with catastrophes and disasters and we're sharing them, in a mass way, what are we noodling on? What bone are we chewing on? And I find myself thinking sometimes, you know, I think the next thing is we go beyond blame. I think that's the next thing. I think the next thing is we go beyond right and wrong and whose fault is it and blame. And we go into some space that's really about compassion and kindness and service, and developing the sense of we, developing the sense of it's all us. Every story we see out there, every news story, every enemy, it's all us. There's only one person here. It's us, and it's the human. You know, I think possibly what we're in the business of birthing right now is a fully awakened a fully awakened humanity that thinks as one, that thinks as one being, like bees do, like ants do, like other creatures do, that work together for the good of the whole. I think we're coming out of a really long period of being blind individuals and trying to, you know, understand who we really are as a whole. And that's who we really are all together.
That is fascinating. I've never, I think you just have illustrated it in a new way. Hearing the concept, we are one, there's a lot of that language being spoken these days. But what does that really mean? And I still have always thought about it from like an individuated point of view, like that as an individual, like, okay, we are one, so it's important to have compassion and see my face in the face of another. But wow, it takes it to a whole new level if you think about operating the way bees and ants do, that they operate as a collective and as a colony. They're like wired, hardwired to do that.
There's some mind that they are inside of. They're inside like a big bee mind or a big ant mind. And so individuals are playing whatever part, like wherever they're being sent to go. And, you know, I work with a lot of people who are in the healing arts, and a lot of people in the healing arts and people on the spiritual path do have a good sense of we and oneness consciousness and have a more difficult sense of boundary and like, well, what's mine to do and what's mine not to do? What's mine to, you know, do something about, what's mine to just let it go and accept this is the way it is? And another way I like to think about this is that the human species is one thing, and we're dealing right now with a disease. We're dealing right now with the disease of our ignorance and the weight of our ignorance and how it's hurting everybody, that we don't, you know, really act for everyone's good. And I think that in my life, I'm like one little white blood cell in the body. Like if you have an infection in your body, you get all these white blood cells, and they all run to the infection and take care of it. And this healer over there and this good minister over here and this high school teacher over there, everyone who's walking with really conscious goodwill for all of us is like a white blood cell in that expanded body of who we all are. And what's nice to know for me is that I don't have to try and heal the whole thing. I just need to be sent to my one little corner where my people are waiting for me to heal them and then let that go. And I can trust that this, you know, homeless person over here and this disordered person over there, but they have their healers. They have their white blood cells out there. I don't have to help every single person that comes across my path. And so I think that's where, as we awaken spiritually, we get more and more intuitive about where we are in the stream of things and what's ours to do and what isn't.
I think that's so important for all of us to realize, again, kind of wrapping all these concepts together, you know, taking our rightful place, that true humility is agreeing to take your rightful place, whatever that is and whatever that may look like. And it's not high or low, and it's not big or small, but it is your rightful place and being willing to stand there in all of your brilliance and glory. And then with the concept of healing your little corner, you know, healing your peeps, the people who are brought to you and are yours to heal, and saying yes to that and not being distracted by this grandiose expectation that, you know, it's your job to heal the world. That's crazy. We all need to work together here. And I know your work on forgiveness is such important work, because truly, in order to be able to be a healing agent for others, we first have to start by healing ourselves. And even the notion of the wounded healer still goes through a process of healing themselves before they can then really be able to help others. And I know that I have been cautioned repeatedly in my life that, you know, before I work with a healer of any kind, it's so important to check in with, like, their level of integrity and, like, have they done the work themselves? Because otherwise, it's not advisable to open yourself to someone who hasn't done the work themselves. And clearly, the area of forgiveness is where one of the most important places where we can start with healing ourselves. So in the time that's left in our interview, I wanted to ask you to go in depth a little bit more into your forgiveness work and leave our listeners with some nuggets that they can take away with them so that they can begin healing the corners of their hearts that need to be healed.
That's a nice way of putting it. Well, I think forgiveness is one of the central human questions and central tasks of our evolution, just like the same, in the same way as the notion of free will is. Free will and forgiveness are like huge spiritual questions in front of every human being in every religion in every country. It's two of the big bones we're chewing on. And forgiveness is a central practice in every world religion. And it is only now starting to come into its time. And I think it's taken us a long, long time to realize that forgiveness is for our own sake, that it doesn't mean you're saying what happened was okay, somebody did something wrong. What it is saying, you know what, they're responsible for their wrong actions, I need to heal and move on. How do I do that? How do I do that? And so in this work, this body of work, unconditional forgiveness that was developed by my mentor, Dr. Stauffer, and it was refined by me and is still growing and going out into the world more and more, we're saying that forgiveness is something that we do for ourselves, and that if you work an issue through all the parts of your being, your will, your feelings, your mind, your boundaries, your energy system, your soul, and your relationship with life and your relationship with the other person, it dissolves. This burden, this stagnant, dark wound you've been carrying along, doesn't matter if you've been carrying it for 2 years or 20 years, it dissolves. It can dissolve in 45 minutes. When you're ready and you know what to do, forgiveness happens. So my book was written with the intention of really synthesizing and bringing together my very best understandings and stories and insights about forgiveness, which I've gained over teaching it all over the place for 25 years. It's all synthesized down into this, like, okay, so now here's how you do it. Here's how you do it. Here's a chapter one, use your will. Chapter two, here's the feelings part of it. Chapter three, here's how you dissolve this attachment in your mind. Chapter four, here's how you reestablish your boundaries and give and take your own space back. Chapter five, here's how you reach to the energy and the healing light of your soul. And here's now when you send it out to that other person and release them. And here's when you open up to the universe to give you what you need. And in the end, here's how you see the good in a person or situation. It's very simple. It's a really simple and elegant and complete model, and I can't take full credit for it because it was, you know, handed to me. But I've had the good fortune of watching thousands of people shed burdens and watching their posture change and a light come into their eyes and their complexion brighten up and they start laughing and they start thinking all the things they want to do next and they feel more like there's doorways there that they can walk through because they're not stuck in this wound. It's really the joy of my life to watch that moment of freedom happen, and you never get used to it. So I hope that if people are interested in and wanting to get a really nice hands-on coaching about how forgiveness happens, it's in my book, Unconditional Forgiveness, A Simple and Proven Method to Forgive Everyone and Everything.
So that's Unconditional Forgiveness, A Simple and Proven Method to Forgive Everyone and Everything. So, Mary, are you doing most of your speaking these days on forgiveness, or are you speaking also on the Kitchen Mystic?
I do both. I'm a philosopher and a healer, and I still love exploring the big questions. So I do different topics. I have topics for women's organizations, and I do some workplace spirituality topics. And the forgiveness topic is it's a perennial. You know, it's a real a centerpiece of what I do. But, yeah, so both the books are nice. They're good friends for each other. The Kitchen Mystic is the book that you tuck in with at night and enjoy for 10 minutes before bed and go, oh. And the forgiveness one, I hope, sits on the shelf to be used again and again and again as life gets lifey, as a friend of mine calls it. Wow, life gets lifey, and then you have to forgive. So.
Yes, I love that. That's a, such a great quote. Life gets lifey. Oh, it's
life gets lifey. Yes.
So
and it's really a path of mastery. It's all about mastery, self-mastery, and really mastering the human gig. It's not an easy thing to master.
Yes.
And we need our mighty companions.
That's right. Yes, you talk about that in here, like mastering, you know, being human, and that that's the path that we're all on. So what is the best way for our listeners to stay in touch with you and keep abreast of what you have going on? Is Facebook the best platform, or do you have a website?
I have a website, and you'll have to forgive my website this week because it's in transition, and it's kind of old and dated, like it needs a new haircut, but it's coming out all fresh in the next 3 weeks. So look at it today and look at it in 3 weeks, and I'll be happy. It's MaryHaysGreco.com or ForgivenessTraining.com.
Okay.
In either way, and you'll get there, and you'll find lots of information around the forgiveness work and more about me and my background and some videos and whatnot. So you'll forgive me the dated material on this week's website, and you'll look again in 3 weeks and go, oh, she spiffed that up. And I'll have a blog. The blog on the new website is called The Blue Couch, just like my radio show was. And I hope that I'll meet some more companions and friends on the journey on my blog in coming times.
That sounds great. I will be sure to check it out and participate on your blog by sending responses. So we will give that information to our listeners again in just a minute, and I'll be sure to spell your last name for them to make sure that they get it right. So I want to thank you so much for taking time this afternoon. It was such a joy to get to speak with you. I have to say, I mean, this is just my very, very favorite part of my job, because there is nothing more heavenly than reading a book that you just adore cover to cover. You love it so much, and then have the opportunity to sit down and talk with the author for an hour is just incredible. I swear, I'm like the luckiest person in the entire world. So.
Really? I thought I was the luckiest person. Well, we must be good friends then.
Yes.
We have loved the same things.
We're both in our rightful place, right?
That's right. Exactly. Very good.
Oh, Mary, this has been delightful and powerful and inspiring. Thank you so much. It's everything that I hoped it would be, and I look forward to keeping up with the future projects that you're putting out there, and I'll for sure visit your blog.
Thank you so much, Tara.
Okay, have a great day.
You too. Thanks. All the best.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
You're listening to WAIF Cincinnati 88.3 FM, Waves of a New Age, bringing you soul-filled sounds and conscious conversation every Tuesday afternoon from 3 to 5 p.m. I'm your host, Tara Robinson, and I am just wrapping up a powerful interview with Mary Hayes Greco, the author of The New Kitchen Mystic. I love this little book, and you can learn more about her. Like she said, she's updating her website, so don't pass judgment too quickly. Visit it today, but then visit again in 3 weeks. And her web address is MaryHaysGreco.com, which is her name, .com, but Greco is spelled G-R-I-E-C-O, G-R-I-E-C-O, Hayes is H-A-Y-E-S. So it's Mary, M-A-R-Y, H-A-Y-E-S, Greco, G-R-I-E-C-O.com. I want to read a part at the end of the book because this, I think, sums it all up. It says, that's the trouble when you give yourself wholeheartedly to the evolution of your higher consciousness. Eventually, it works. And then she says, I have given myself to the cause of the evolution of human consciousness. I am a spiritual worker. The only thing that really matters to me is to grow up to be wise and free and help other people do so too. I work on my own consciousness by being obedient to the healing directions coming from my higher self. And as I master each facet of it, people come to me for help. There are people ahead of me. They guide and inspire me to greater self-mastery as I hope to guide and inspire others. Starting in your own life today, make an athletic leap to the higher ground that is calling you. There is no more room, no more time for fear or withholding from truth and love in our world. Come out of fear and control. Submit to living your love and inner beauty in your daily engagements. All the help you could possibly need is right here, right now. Agree to shine in service of truth. So, on that note, I would like to invite all of you who are local listeners in the Cincinnati area to join us this evening at Infusion. Tonight's special title is Infusion Ignites, because we are igniting our lights into a full-blown bonfire. Infusion Cincinnati meets every second Tuesday of the month at Rose Street Cafe from 6:30 to 7:30 in the evening. That's at 245 West McMillan Street, so it's right in Clifton. It's an awesome cafe. The ambiance in there is just the coolest place to be. Infusion is hot, it's fresh, it's current, it's trendy, it's swaggy, it's very cool. And it says, join the brightest game changers in town as we explore how to live with passion and purpose. We're adventurers and revolutionaries who get together to share aha moments and soul nourishment. The goal is shining powerfully together so we can light up this city. Light up the city. Please join us tonight as we light up the city. Tonight is open mic night, so everyone who is in attendance will have an opportunity to speak. All of you, again, who are local listeners, consider this question. If you had 5 minutes to talk about your passion, what would you say? What would you say in that time? So come out and join us. Rose Street Cafe tonight. I'll be there. I'm facilitating tonight, beginning at 6:30, so right after this radio show concludes at 5 o'clock, I'm heading over there. Again, it's every second Tuesday from 6:30 to 7:30 at Rose Street Cafe, and you can learn more on Facebook at Infusion Cincinnati. You can also visit the website, infusioncincinnati.com, or follow us on Twitter, Infusion Cincy, at Infusion Cincy. Okay, so we were wrapping up the interview with Mary Hayes Greco by talking about forgiveness. We are going to listen to a song about forgiveness. This is Sean Galloway's song, Breathe a Little Magic. And pay attention, because the words say, breathe a little magic into forgiveness. So please sit back and integrate everything you've learned and everything that has been shifted here this afternoon. Take a deep breath. Let the magic of this song work its magic on you, bring you into balance, bring you into joy, bring you into fulfillment and excitement about taking your rightful place in the world. And we'll be back very soon. Again, I'm your host, Tara Robinson, and you're listening to WAIF Cincinnati 88.3 FM.
When the world's got you down.